Now, the two stories that we're going to be looking at today are about people who have come to the end of the road with what human ingenuity and knowledge can do for them. They have nowhere else to turn but to Jesus Christ, and when they reach out to Him for help, He helps them. And, you know, we do a similar kind of thing in our life oftentimes, don't we? I mean, we try to find help for our problems and our situations everywhere we can before finally turning to the Lord for help. I know I do that. I exhaust every possible avenue. And then finally, well, I guess I'm going to have to pray about it as a last resort, since I can't do it myself. Now, last time we read the story about a man who was possessed by a very large number of demons who had enslaved him and robbed him of everything good in life. He was violent. He was self-destructive. He was harmful to others. He was out of control. He was uncontrollable. But Jesus set him free and gave him a new life. And today we're going to pick up our story in the Gospel of Luke right where it leaves off with that story. Jesus and his disciples have now gotten back in their boat and sailed back across the Sea of Galilee to the other side from which they had originally left. And we begin in Luke chapter 8, verse 40. It says, When Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Jesus and his disciples, they've returned to the west side and to the north side, really, northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. And the people on the east side of the lake, if you'll recall, where the demon-possessed man had lived, they asked Jesus to leave that region last week in the story because they were afraid of him. The power that Jesus had over the spirit world in this man, who had been a literal nightmare for these people for years, was something that they did not understand. It scared them. And really, that kind of power that was displayed in that particular thing is the kind of power that can either comfort us or be a terror to us, depending on whether we know and trust the one who has that power. They didn't know Jesus. They didn't trust Jesus. They just wanted him to leave, and so he left them. Now, as soon as Jesus arrives on the other side of the lake, this large crowd immediately gathers around him. It says they were all expecting him. The crowd had been looking for Jesus ever since he had left. And the popularity and the celebrity status of Jesus is highlighted for us here, and we see what a high popularity he was enjoying at this particular time in his ministry among the general people. In verse 41, it says, then a man named Jairus, a ruler of the synagogue, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. Jairus, it says, is a synagogue ruler. And a synagogue ruler was a person who oversaw the functioning of the synagogue, which was the Jewish version of a church in our day, including the supervising of the worship service itself, maintaining order. He was highly respected, and he was a prominent member of the local community. The love that Jairus has for his daughter and the level of concern that he has for her life is painfully obvious here in the way that he is behaving. He leaves all of his dignity and pride behind, and he falls at the feet of Jesus, and he pleads with him to heal his only daughter. Now, it's likely that he was probably a critic of Jesus and his ministry, right along with all of the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, various other religious leaders. You'll remember they were the ones who really opposed Jesus at every turn, and Jairus, in all likelihood, was part of that particular crowd. But now reality comes rushing in on him, and his own precious child is about to die. And it's interesting, really, how crisis can change our attitudes about things. I mean, who cares what people think now? My daughter's life is at stake. There are a lot of atheists and agnostics when circumstances are manageable. But when tragedy strikes, when it looks like the things and the people that we love and cherish are about to be torn from us, when life becomes truly unmanageable, people start praying. All of our fancy big talk about not believing in God gets thrown out the window, and we get down on our knees and we start praying, no matter how clumsy and unfamiliar that experience might feel to us. Jesus agrees to go with Jairus to his house. And as Jesus is on his way to Jairus' house, he's interrupted. We have here a story inside of the story. It says here that as Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. The first thing for us to note in this new story is the size and the nature of the crowd that is traveling along with Jesus as he makes his way to Jairus' house. It says the crowds almost crushed him. And the Greek word that's translated crushed in the New International Version of the Bible is a word that literally means to strangle completely, to drown, to suffocate. And it's really a vivid word that is being used to describe this huge crowd of people who are all pushing and shoving, trying to get a look at Jesus and hear what he's saying and get as close as they possibly can to him as they all move in this mass of humanity that's pressing in, all trying to inch its way forward towards Jairus' house. This is the scene that we have. Hundreds of people. We're introduced to a woman here who's been struggling and suffering with a continual bleeding for the past 12 years. But no one could heal her, it says. And we learn in Mark's account of this same story in Mark 5:26 that she had spent all that she had in going to these various doctors over the years trying to find some relief and help for her condition. And it says that instead of getting better, she grew worse. Losing blood like this would have drained her of strength. She felt exhausted and weak all of the time. It's hard for us to imagine someone suffering for 12 years with a condition like this. Long, unrelenting pain is one of the most difficult trials that a human ever has to face. I mean, we can muster up the strength to take on some short-lived pain, even if it's very intense. I mean, how many Westerns have we watched where, you know, the guy says, just give me a bullet to bite on, and I can take it while you remove the arrow or whatever. Because, you know, we can strengthen up for that short-lived, sharp pain. But the pain that's always present, that is always there, that's the kind that works on our mental state. It interrupts and it disturbs everything in our life. It's a constant, unwelcome companion that just grinds us down, setting the rest of our entire life on edge all of the time. And this is the kind of condition, the kind of pain, the kind of life that this woman has lived for the last 12 years. Well, unfortunately, her suffering is not confined to just the physical pain and the mental fatigue that came with this. Because of her bleeding, she's considered ceremonially, religiously unclean or contaminated. The Jewish religious laws that address this particular thing are found in Leviticus chapter 15, verses 19 through 30. If you're interested, you can read about that stuff later. But to summarize, it says that no one was to touch her. Not even a family member, or they too would become religiously unclean themselves. Anything that she sat on or that she laid on was considered contaminated, unclean, not to be touched by another person. According to the religious law, she would not even really be in a crowd like this. She was not behaving properly in a social sense to even be there that day. She shouldn't have been in that crowd because she is contaminating everyone around her as they touch her unknowingly in this crowd. Now, because of the social stigma associated with such ailments in that culture and time, the mental anguish that this woman suffers from, it must have been just as difficult, if not more so, than the physical pain. And she's another example of someone considered untouchable by society. But Jesus, he looks past the exterior to the heart and is concerned for each person as an individual, regardless of the labels that society has attached to them. You remember the leper as an example. We can think about the demoniac from last week. None of these boundaries that society erects ever prevents Jesus from touching people. Some of you may even feel like that, that you are one of society's untouchables. And I want you to know that you are never an untouchable to Jesus Christ. He loves you and always will. In verse 44, it says, she came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. So she comes to Jesus because she is convinced that he is able to heal her, but because of her ceremonial uncleanness, she approaches him from the rear, sneaking up, hoping no one, including Jesus, will notice her and what she's about to do. And then she reaches through the crowd of people and she touches the edge of Jesus' garment. And it says that she's immediately healed. She knows in herself, in her body, that she has been healed. After 12 years, this woman is finally freed from her suffering, and she certainly is the happiest woman in Galilee in this moment, until Jesus stops and he turns around and he begins to look among the people in the crowd and he asks, "Who touched me?" She had hoped to be able to pull this thing off without being detected, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Verse 45, "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." So not only has this woman felt something happen when she touched Jesus, but Jesus, he felt something too. It says that he felt power go out from him. What a wild thing to think about, isn't it? He felt power go out from him. And Jesus insists on knowing who it is that has touched him and who has received his healing power. He says, "Who touched me?" And his disciples, they may have thought that this had to be one of the stupidest questions they have ever heard another human being ask. "Who touched you?" There are hundreds of people pressing in around him right now. You remember the way Luke describes it? The crowd almost crushed him. The disciples, they may have been tempted to actually say, "Pick one. Any of the people within eyeshot, any of these hundreds of people, Jesus, they all touched you." I think the disciples were also concerned with getting Jesus to Jairus' daughter on time, a real emergency in their estimation. Why are you wasting time trying to find out who touched you in this gigantic crowd of people when this little girl is dying? We don't have time for this stuff, Jesus. We have an emergency situation on our hands. This man's daughter is dying. Let's go. Let's get moving. Sometimes we tell Jesus that about ourselves too, don't we? "What are you doing? We have an emergency situation on our hands. I'm dying. Let's get moving." He asks, "Who touched me?" "Who cares? Who touched you?" Now, Jesus' motivation for knowing who touched him is not to rebuke this woman or to embarrass her or to shame her or to criticize her. He wants to make personal contact with her and to affirm God's love for her. See, God, he doesn't just throw some blessings into the general direction of people like wind blowing through a crowd. The Lord blesses people specifically and intentionally. Jesus wants this woman to know that God knows what has happened to her, that God intended what has happened to her, that God is pleased to give her what he has given her. Jesus wants her to be able to receive God's grace without any guilt or fear. God has blessed her. Jesus wants her to live in the center of that blessing and to worship God openly and unreservedly because of it. So then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." This woman, she comes forward, she's trembling with fear, and she confesses to Jesus what she's done. And she's probably thinking, "Oh, I've done it now. I'm going to really get it." And it isn't that just how so many people see God, that he's out to get us, that he's out to make our life miserable or to punish us in some way. And any blessing that we do manage to get from God is seen as though we have gotten away with something that we shouldn't have. Like a little kid who sneaks candy out of the jar that he's not supposed to. This is the third story in a row where people are afraid of Jesus because of his power. And just like the other two times, that fear is misplaced. Remember his disciples? They were afraid of him when he calmed the wind and the waves out in the middle of the sea. He calmed them and they were afraid and they asked, "Who is this?" And then last week in the story, the people were afraid of Jesus when he cured this man who was suffering from demon possession. And they asked him to leave because they were afraid of him. And now this woman, she's afraid of him. But Jesus calls her daughter. And this is the only time recorded in the Gospels when Jesus addresses a woman like this, calling a woman daughter. And it shows his tenderness toward her, his compassion and his love for her, his understanding of her and her pain and her misery and her fear. It's ironic that there is no one in all of existence to be feared more than Jesus, and at the same time, no one in all of existence who can be trusted more. Now, if Jesus had not persisted in having this woman come forward, she may have gone away thinking that she has basically stolen something from God. She has secretly taken something from Jesus without asking for his permission. But Jesus, making her come forward and confessing what she has done, gave him opportunity to say to her, "God freely gave that to you. God freely healed you. You didn't steal anything. God loves you, and he has blessed you intentionally and specifically and personally. Go and have peace about what's happened to you today." I think Jesus also has her come forward so that he can publicly declare her clean before these other people. He addresses not only her physical pain, but also the psychological pain that she has lived with. She's able to now move about in public without the shame that she's carried for the last 12 years. Verse 49, it says, "While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. 'Your daughter is dead,' he said. 'Don't bother the teacher anymore.'" So while Jesus is still speaking with the woman, some men come up and they give Jairus the news that his daughter has died, that there is no point at this time in having Jesus continue on to the house. Now, can you imagine what devastating news this would have been for Jairus? As a father myself of two precious daughters, I can tell you that there is nothing that would pain me more than to lose either one of them. This is his only daughter. And Jairus' heart is crushed. He'd swallowed his pride. He had rushed to get Jesus to save his precious daughter's life. And now all of this effort has been for naught. The nightmare that he dreaded most has now come true. She's dead. His daughter has died. And can you hear the disciples? I think they must have kind of raised their eyebrows and looked at each other with that knowing look, like, we all pretty much are thinking the same thing, aren't we? And under their breath, they're saying, "See, I told you so. I knew this was going to happen. Jesus shouldn't have wasted all that time with this woman. Now what do we got? We got nothing. This little girl is dead. We at least had a shot at saving her before, but not any longer. She's gone." Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed." When they arrived at the house of Jairus, he didn't let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. So Jesus, he ignores what people are saying, and he turns to Jairus and he says, "Don't be afraid, just believe." And then he separates himself from this large crowd of people and takes just the essential few to witness what's going to take place, along with the little girl's mom and dad. And based on the records in the four Gospels, we see that Peter, James, and John really form this tighter circle of three that are with Jesus many times. And then John is the one that is referred to in his own gospel as the one whom Jesus loved. Held a special place with Jesus. But in verse 52, it says, "Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her." "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. So when Jesus arrived at Jairus' house, he encounters this great commotion of people weeping and wailing over this dead girl. I mean, they're starting to have the funeral. The custom of the day was to hire professional mourners to wail and mourn for your dead loved ones. Professional mourners have already arrived and they're at work here at Jairus' house. And I've always thought, what a strange career that would be. What do you do for a living? "I'm a mourner." "Really?" "Yeah, you know, pay's okay. Benefits not too bad." "What do you do?" "I wail." "Okay. Is it, like, fulfilling?" You know what I mean? "What? It's just a weird job, you know." Well, Jairus, he's a man with a prominent position. He has some wealth. So there's probably a large number of mourners working at the scene. And Jesus asked him to stop wailing because the girl is not dead, but asleep. Well, what does Jesus mean when he says the girl is asleep? Is she in a coma rather than being really dead? Probably not. People even in those days knew when a person was dead. The mourners who are there already, they laugh at him. Like, we know a dead person when we see one. She's dead. She's dead. But Jesus refers to this condition of hers as sleeping because he's going to bring her back to life. It's a temporary thing. It's like sleep. And you know, death is referred to as sleeping in the New Testament, on more than one occasion, actually, pointing out this temporary nature of death for a Christian. When verse 54, it says, "He took her by the hand and said, 'My child, get up.' Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened." So the little girl is immediately brought back to life by Jesus, and the reaction of those who are present is astonishment, as it would be for us as well. And then Jesus gives two instructions. The first is, he says, "Give the girl something to eat." And I like that, because that's where I live too. I mean, if it had been me, I would want someone to give me something to eat after something like that. If I was present, I would want to give the girl something to eat. See, because when I'm sick, the last activity that I give up is eating. And the first activity that I resume when I'm no longer sick is eating. That's just where I live. That's me. I like to eat. Eating makes me feel better. And I think it makes Jairus' daughter feel better too. The second instruction that he gives is, he tells him not to tell anyone about what has happened. Now, obviously, this event is not going to go completely unnoticed. Those who have been there wailing and mourning at this funeral, they're going to recognize this girl tomorrow, walking the streets and go, "Hey, aren't you that girl that we were having the funeral for yesterday?" Yeah, they'll recognize her. But Jesus wants to minimize the spread of what has happened as much as possible. We've talked about this before, but there was a real danger that the people would try to force Jesus to be this political Messiah, to be a king in Israel, to overthrow the Roman oppression and rise Israel to this great status as a world power. That's the kind of Messiah they were looking for, but that's not the kind of Messiah that Jesus was. He had not come to be that kind of Messiah, and that was not God's plan for the Messiah that he had sent to the world. You know, raising someone from the dead was not an everyday occurrence. And if this kind of thing got out about Jesus, I mean, who knows what might happen? There's a man over there who can raise the dead, who raises dead people. And you know, bringing your sick to Jesus is one thing, but bringing your dead to Jesus is something else entirely, isn't it? And I really don't think he wanted that stuff to start up like that. I mean, that could just get completely out of control. Finally, I think sometimes we forget that death is not the end. And this life is not the best that we have to look forward to. Being brought back to this life is not the best that can ever happen to us. In closing this morning, in the stories that we looked at today, we have seen people who had come to the end of the line with what they could do for themselves. And when they reach out to the Lord for help, he proves himself faithful and capable. He told Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe." And you might be in a situation similar to Jairus, a situation that looks completely hopeless, and everyone around you is telling you to give up. Don't bother the teacher anymore. But Jesus is saying, don't be afraid. Just believe. Trust me. You might be in a situation similar to this woman who timidly sneaks up behind Jesus in the crowd and is healed by touching his garment. You have sought relief from your suffering from every avenue that you can think of without any success. I want to encourage you, go to Jesus Christ. Maybe you feel you are so unworthy of God's kindness and blessing that you're trying to sneak up and take a blessing without really asking. But you're forgetting about God's grace. He blesses and he extends kindness to those who are unworthy. That's what grace is all about. He loves you. He wants to help you. He wants you to know his true nature. Don't be afraid of him. Finally, you might be like the disciples, confused about what the Lord's doing, thinking that he's overlooking the obvious, that he's wasting valuable time, that he's getting distracted with side issues. Trust him. He knows what he's doing. Let's close in prayer. Lord, we thank you for these stories today. What a beautiful reminder they are of your nature, of what you're really like, of your true heart, Lord. I pray for your people here this morning that feeling discouraged and at a loss, Lord, that you would come beside them this morning and remind them that you've not forgotten them, Lord. Help us to not be afraid, but to believe and to trust you. I pray for those too, Lord, this morning who maybe feel that they're unworthy to receive any kindness or blessing from you. They feel on the outside, on the fringe. They're untouchable, Lord. I pray that you would affirm your love to them and, God, that you would draw them into a place of close communion with you. Bless your people in Christ's name. Amen.